The book of Ecclesiastes,
as we began in it last week, draws us into understanding and examining our lives from the perspective of what does it mean to live in this world? What does it mean to be a follower of God? And he seems to take a very dismal and very critical, very cynical look at things. In fact, there's a couple of phrases, as we learned last week, become prominent throughout the book. And one is this idea of vanity. Vanity of vanities. Everything is meaningless. Everything is purposeless. Nothing has really any helpfulness. Everything is kind of despair and glum and terrible, and we're all going to die in a big fiery ball of disaster. That's kind of how it seems. And he qualifies that by saying that all of these things, and the majority of them he's going to speak about, and much of what we'll speak about today, is this concept of what is under the sun. He's not talking about what God is necessarily doing, but if you take the perspective, kind of separate yourself for a moment into this idea that what is life like without considering God? What is life like when we just simply say, under the sun, on this earth, as we go about our daily lives, not giving much thought to God, what is the purpose? What is the value in it all? And so we looked at a bit at that last week. And this week, what we want to do is look at several passages within the book of Ecclesiastes to kind of set the stage for some of the other things that we're going to speak about. And we're going to deal with some facts of life. There is this really big thing that is going on. I don't know if you follow any of the media or follow the news or politics or things like that, but there's this big thing that's going around for the last couple years about what is fake news. This is fake news and that's fake news, and different parties are accusing each other of fake news and the media is fake and all these things. And they're trying to change the truth. We're trying to understand reality, and we're trying to help other people to believe certain things. Now, some people think that there's such a thing as competing facts. But when you have something that's a fact, by definition, a fact is something that has the quality of being actual, of being true. So you cannot have two things that are directly opposite of each other be true at the same time. It doesn't work. You cannot have that the moon is hot and say that the moon is hot, and at the same time say the moon is cold. Those are competing ideas. One is true and one is not. So it's a wonder that we live in this world where people are trying to tell us quite differently that things can happen that way. But what we want to do is we want to understand what is true, what is the facts. And as we continue to learn from Ecclesiastes, who is probably the writer, Solomon, is probably the wisest, probably the wealthiest person who has ever lived, what he does is he shares with us some of the undeniable facts of life. And he wants us to know what life is, what truth is, what life is about under the sun. So we begin, and I would invite you to turn in your Bibles to chapter 3, 1 to 15 of the book of Ecclesiastes. This is probably a passage of the book of Ecclesiastes that you are most familiar with. If you've ever listened to 60s music and the birds, then you know this music. You know this portion of Scripture. And here is fact one. Here's the fact of life. God rules over every season of life. It says this: for everything there is a season, and a time for every matter under heaven, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to break down and a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together, a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to seek and a time to lose, a time to keep and a time to cast away, a time to tear and a time to sow, a time to keep silence and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time for war and a time for peace. Then I want to skip down to verse 14. We're going to come back to 9 to 13 later. But down to 14, it says, I perceived that whatever God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it, nor anything taken away from it. God has done it so that people fear before him. That which is already has been. That which is to be already has been. And God seeks what has been driven away. Now, when we consider time, what do we think about? Sometimes we can think about the hands of a clock, how there's hours in a day and there's days in a week. Sometimes we can think about different sayings that consider the idea of time. We might say, well, you know, time is short, or time waits for no man. Or we might be doing something, go, where did the time go? Or we say that something is the right time to do something, so we say there's no time like the present. Sometimes we look at something we're doing and saying, well, that was a real waste of time. Or we say, you know what, life is short, I've lived a good long life, I'm on borrowed time. Or we might say that, you know, life is a race against time. All of these things are sayings pertaining to time. And what's interesting about time is both a fact and it is a perception. It is a fact in the sense that there are 60 seconds in 1 minute, and there are 60 minutes in 1 hour, and there's 24 hours in 1 day, and there's 365 days and a quarter in 1 year. 1 minute goes by, and you can never recover that minute. Minutes have gone by, and you can't get them back. Never, ever, 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 ever again will you ever get that minute back. But we also perceive time relatively. When you have a deadline that you have to do, you have a paper due, and it's a week away, and then 3 days away, and then 1 day away. Boy, does time go fast. Or when you're in a situation where you're having fun and you're excited about what you're doing, maybe you're on vacation or maybe that kind of thing, and you go, wow, where did the time go? Man, it just flew by. But time is slow in other circumstances. I'm waiting for the kettle to boil, just taking forever and ever. Or if you're a child and it's Christmas time and you're waiting for the day in which you're going to open your presents, time just takes forever. It just drags on, and it's all so boring. It takes so long. It's horrible. Time seems to get away from us. I think it's very true, and you only realize this as you get older. When you're younger, time seems to be like you have, like it just so, it goes so slowly. But as you get older and older, time seems to get slower. But there's 60 seconds in a minute, and there's 60 minutes in an hour. That hasn't changed. But our perception of time has changed. Now, we would expect that this would be true everywhere, but it's not. There's different people in different cultures, and they value time differently. There are people that are a stickler for time. They have a clock in every single room. They have a watch on their wrist, and they think that if you're not on time, if you don't keep time, if you miss an appointment or if you're late or whatever, that is one of the greatest sins you can commit. You can go murder someone, but that's not as important as being on time. And then there's the other side of it, where, you know what, time is just a suggestion. What time is this starting? Well, when people get there. Well, how do you know when that is? Well, when they come. You can probably tell at this point which one I am not, because that would drive me crazy. They don't watch the time. They don't own a watch. They have no clue. They don't like schedules. And then there are whole cultures like this. And you know who you are. You know who you are. You know, you have one side, one culture that strictly keeps the time, and then you have other cultures where they think that time is flexible like a rubber band. It just comes, you know, just, oh, a minute? Oh, that's about 4 minutes. What time are we getting there? Around then, you know? And then there's the rest of us says, no, it's 1 minute past. You're late. You're in trouble. Now, we would expect that Koheleth would regard time with cynicism. And the preacher would tell us that time is this cruel master and that you cannot recapture time and that time is going to ruin your life. He would tell us that paying attention to time is a vanity because you can't control it and it will ruin your life. It gives you no freedom. It is a waste of time because time disappears. Time is vanity and a striving after wind. But that's not what he says. The preacher looks at time differently. He doesn't look at it as minutes and seconds and hours like we do on a clock or in our day when we're keeping an appointment. He doesn't look at it that way. He looks at this as a season. What he's saying is that there is a time, there is a season, there is an appointed purpose for everything under heaven, everything under the sun. He is saying that there is a place for everything, a timing for everything, a reason for everything. And he provides this very familiar and very beautiful poem that uses two lines in each verse to give us contrasting ideas that describe what he's saying. It seems that the preacher would seem at one end, as you just read the poem, that he might be a bit fatalistic, a person that kind of feels like all should be given up, nothing is worth trying. He's kind of trapped in the tyranny of time. There's a time for this to happen, and there's a time for that to happen, and it doesn't really matter what you do or what you do in your life, nothing's going to change. But that isn't quite true, because in verse 11, he says, God has made everything beautiful in its time. So it's just not all cynicism and vanity. What he is telling us is this fact of life that is under the sun, that God is sovereign and rules over all human events. The preacher here understands that nothing happens outside of the will of God. God has ordained the proper time for all things. Now, we can try to argue with this and even explain away God's rule, his reign, his sovereignty, and we can plan and his plan for all things in their right time. And many try to do this. And we might find it difficult that God would have that kind of control, that he would have what I would say is meticulous concern over his creation. But I believe that the facts that are there are reassuring. See, what happens in this life is not just circumstantial, random events. It is just not happenstance and luck. What it is not random. It is not purposelessness. It is not the destruction of this world. It is not the acts of a madman who just wants to see the world burn. But we don't understand it. We don't understand what happens. But if you look at verses 14 and 15, we come to a greater understanding, hopefully, of what is positive about what God is doing. He tells us here that everything that God does will last, that it will endure forever. If he intends for your life to be 84 years on this earth, that is exactly what will happen. Without a doubt. You can be assured of it. And if he makes a promise, if he says that he will return to this earth one day, that he will come to take to heaven his people, then you can be assured of that with 100% confidence, because our God will do exactly what he says. Everything that God does will last. It endures forever. He also tells us that everything that God does is perfect. Nothing can be added to it, he says, and nothing can be taken away. God's power, in his power, he will ensure that what happens is not just a little bit like he intended or mostly like he intended, but exactly as he intends. We cannot improve on his perfection. We cannot make what he has done and make it better, but we do, don't we? We look at life events and he says, you know what? If I could really go back in time, you know what? I think I would, Lord, I would do that a little differently. You know, if you would have done this and done this, I think that would have gone better for me. And we can rationalize and we can try to have that kind of discussion with God. But the problem is that we don't know the bigger picture. We don't know what God is doing and how he's intertwining everything that's happening together. You got to imagine our lives, the lives of every single person through eternity, from the beginning of his creation to the time in which he will return, as people who are interwoven in this giant tapestry, and every little thread has meaning and purpose in God's greater plan. And if we mess with that, if we think that we can tell God how he should do it because we think he could do it better, all we're doing is just looking from our perspective. All we're doing is looking from our selfish understanding of what would be better for me rather than what is for the greater good of everything, including our good. We can't improve on what God is doing. He also says that everything that God does is founded in his eternal decree. He says, what is already has been, what will be already has been. See, what God has done is he has carefully blueprinted our existence, the course of our lives, the history of what is going to happen, the history of everything. God does not look at things and say, you know what, I hope this happens. I hope it goes this way. He doesn't hope on anything. God doesn't have to hope. He does. And it happens. Nothing is mysterious to him. He is outside of time. He works within eternity. Time is a concession for us. And maybe if you're Hispanic, you're a little closer to God because he doesn't need time. Maybe you don't. I don't know. We can maybe rationalize that. But, you know, outside of time, all that is and all that will be has already taken place. Can you grab that? All that has been and all that will be has already occurred. Because God controls it all. We have a God who has the power, as part of his character, part of his perfect love, and part of his mercy, and part of his goodness, and part of his grace, that nothing is outside of his control. And all the things that happen, everything in its season, is exactly as God intends it to be. Now, if you want to take the pessimistic side of this, I suppose you could. But then what we're really doing is we're challenging when God says that he is making all things beautiful in its time. Under the sun, things look bleak. But when we look to heaven, we see something entirely different. We see that God controls and determines when all things will happen, and this is good because he is good and he is perfect. In his perfect timing, in his perfect way, in his intended will, everything will be beautiful in its time. The disaster of your turmoil, the trouble of your life, the circumstances that you did not anticipate or want to happen the way they are there to bring about the beauty of your increased faith. Your failure in your sin, your struggle with maybe something that just will not leave you alone, that continues to dog you, and you lament and you cry over it, is the beauty of God bringing humble repentance to your life. Everything has its time under the close direction of God, so that we will receive beauty for ashes. So we see that the fact is true, that there is a season under heaven for all things under God's control. Here's the second fact, and here I would invite you to turn to chapter 2, starting at verse 14. The fact is this: death is a reality for everyone. So chapter 2, verse 14 to 17, we read this. The wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. And yet I perceive that the same events happen to all of them. Then I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will happen to me also. Why then have I been so very wise? And I said in my heart that this also is vanity. For of the wise as of the fool, there is no enduring remembrance, seeing that in the days to come, all will have been long forgotten. How the wise dies just like the fool. So I hated life, because what is done under the sun was grievous to me, for all is vanity and a striving after wind. Then turn ahead to chapter 3, verses 19 to 21. 3:19-21. And here it says this, for what happens to the children of man and what happens to the beasts is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. They all have the same breath, and man has no advantage over the beasts, for all is vanity. All go to one place, all are from the dust, and to dust all return. Who knows whether the spirit of man goes upward and the spirit of the beast goes down into the earth? And then flip ahead to chapter 8. Chapter 8, verse 8. In chapter 8, verse 8, we read this. No man has power to retain the spirit or power over the day of death. There is no discharge from war, nor will wickedness deliver those who are given to it. And again, skip ahead to chapter 9, verses 1 to 6. And this is what it says there in chapter 9. But all this I laid to heart, examining it all, how the righteous and the wise and their deeds are in the hands of God. Whether it is love or hate, man does not know, both are before him. It is the same for all, since the same events happen to the righteous and the wicked, to the good and the evil, to the clean and the unclean, to him who sacrifices and him who does not sacrifice. As the good one is, so is the sinner, and he who swears is as he who shuns an oath. This is an evil in all that is done under the sun, that the same event happens to all. Also the hearts of the children of man are full of evil, and madness is in their heart while they live, and after they go to the dead. But he who is joined with all the living has hope, for a living dog is better than a dead lion. For the living know that they will die, but the dead know nothing, and they have no more reward, for the memory of them is forgotten. Their love and their hate and their envy have already perished, and forever they have no more share in all that is done under the sun. And then one more, skip ahead to chapter 12, verse 7. And here it says in chapter 12, verse 7, and the dust returns to the earth as it was, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. So this is the other fact, another fact of life, the fact of death. Now, some people would hope to or would strive to deny this fact. There is scientists who are working in the Silicon Valley right now, maybe not today at this hour, but they are working to see if they can prolong life. They figure that through the right kind of genetic coding and whatever else they got to do, they can extend life to a person to 1,000 years. Well, okay, I don't like that idea, but we'll just go with it. There are those who have cryogenically frozen. There's people that have cryogenically frozen their heads in hope that somehow a cure will be found for whatever ails us, and then they can be reanimated or whatever they are. And we can sometimes, we celebrate and we marvel when a person lives a long life. When they live past 100, it gets on the news. My wife, Christine's grandma, lived to be 112 years old. She was the oldest woman in all of Canada at one point. And then we all want to know, well, what is your secret to long life? And apparently, it's a bowl of soup and a pail of cookies. Probably emphasis on the pail of cookies. So many people believe, well, I can prolong life. I can put it off for a long time if I only live a healthy life and diet and exercise and disease prevention, all those things. And then there's the religious or the theological kind of component where there's whole groups of Christians that believe that sickness can be avoided if you just have a little more faith. But the fact remains, as we often know, there are two things in life that are assured, right? It's death and taxes, is the saying. And if even somehow, in some miracle, we could get rid of taxes, death is still there, waiting. So in a number of passages of Ecclesiastes, the preacher shares truths about death for us who live under the sun. And what he says is not pretty. So working backwards in what we read, chapter 12, verse 7. Here it tells us that the fact is that death is inevitable. We return to the dust from which we are made, and hopefully, or we trust in, that as Christians, our spirits will go to be with God. But if we think about this without considering God in the picture, right? If we consider this as God, under the sun only, here's the hard facts. I am going to die, and so are you. We can all go home now. It's been settled. Look at chapter 8, verse 8. Here's another fact. The fact is that we cannot control when we will die. No man, no person, no woman has power over the day of their death. Now, as we said earlier, you might think, well, if I live healthily, and I can have some kind of control over it, but really it's just an illusion. Job chapter 14, verse 5 says that our days are determined by God. Now, does that mean that we just throw up our hands and we say, well, there's no point in taking care of myself, there's no point in exercising? No, I would say it's good for us to take care of ourselves. We need to do so because we are called by God to be good stewards of our lives. But we're not supposed to do it so we can somehow cheat death. We are frail. You can have a person who is an Olympic athlete fall dead at 25 years old. And then you can have a person that is a chain smoker and live to be 90. That's the reality of life. So we're not going to control when we die. God has determined it. Third, in chapter 2, verse 14 to 17, we see the fact is that death does not care if you're wise or you're foolish. Now, you would expect that if you live with wisdom, that you're going to live longer. You would expect that. You know, if you are dumb enough to join a violent gang, the chances are you're going to probably die or get shot. Your life is extremely shortened by the fact that you're going to get involved in things that are going to be potentially harmful to your life. Right? And we'd also expect that if you live wisely, if you stay safe, if you drive within the speed limit, and if you eat well, we would presume that death is going to come upon you late in life. But the preacher, Koheleth, does not seem concerned with anything but this singular truth. It does not matter if you are wise or you're a fool, both are going to die. So the point he's trying to make is, why do we bother trying to live a whole life of wisdom and prudence and all this stuff? Because you're just going to die like the stupid person. You all end the same way. In the grand scheme of things, there is no point to wisdom or folly. And in the end, he says, neither of you are remembered anyway. So what's the point? Well, then in chapter 3 that we read, 19 to 21, it tells us this, that the fact is that death regards us no different than animals. He says that we don't have any advantage over the beasts. We all came from the dust and we will all return to it. And this makes everything a vanity. You have a pig, and a pig is born, and it suckles from its mother, and it grows, and it wallows in the mud, and it grunts, and it stinks, and then it ends up as bacon and back ribs. And we say amen to us pork-eating lovers. But look at us. We are born, we feed from our mothers, we grow, we play in the sandbox, we grunt, and we stink, and we learn, and we educate ourselves, and we apply ourselves to advance ourselves, and then we end up in a box 6 feet under the ground, decaying and turning back to dust. Now, we are so much more intelligent and we are so much more inventive than the smartest animals, and yet we can't do anything to avoid the exact same fate as them. He says, we're the exact same thing. And in fact, sometimes an animal is more useful in death than we are. Then he says, fifthly, in chapter 9, verse 1 to 6, he says, the fact is that death makes no distinction between the evil and the righteous. And on this point, we really have to keep in mind that he's talking about being under the sun, right? I'm going to probably say that like a broken record. We need to remember that he is talking here about the fact is if God is not in the picture, if we're not considering his influence and his sovereignty over all things, if we're just looking under the sun, this is what he says. He distinguishes between those who are evil and those who are righteous. Now, he's not talking about two unbelievers where one person is immoral and gets themselves in all kinds of terrible trouble, and the other person tries to live a good and a good life where they obey the laws and all those kind of things. What he's talking about is the difference between an unbeliever and a believer in God. And in this life, the evil will die, and so will the righteous. If we think that we can avoid death by trusting in God, the preacher says otherwise. It does not make a difference. These are the facts of this life. These are the facts under the sun. And what it should cause us to do, where it should bring us to, is the fact that we do not make this life an idol. We do not put too much hope in this life. We don't make this life a preoccupation. We don't live for this life. He is telling us to not hope in us. We don't hope in our being higher beings. We don't hope in us being smarter or being good. It doesn't come by exercising 3 times a week or keeping to a strict diet or taking this pill or this remedy. He is pointing us to a greater hope. A greater hope that is above the sun, where as Christians, we do not deny our physical death, but we look beyond all of it to eternal life. We look to Jesus Christ, who has defeated death, who has defeated even physical death, and one day we will have our new purified bodies and we will live forever. The preacher is explaining here our hopelessness over death, so that we will turn to God, to turn to Him for our true hope. He is preaching here eternal life. He is declaring the gospel of grace. For what is the fact for humanity? What is the truth? Is that we overcome by Christ, by His mercies, by Him through God, and it comes to a repentant sinner. There is no other way. So the fact is that there's a season for everything. The fact is that death is going to come. And then we want to turn to a third fact. The fact is that life is entirely uncertain. And here we turn to chapter 8. So I invite you to turn to chapter 8. We're going to read verses 16 and 17. Chapter 8, verses 16 and 17 tells us this. When I applied my heart to know wisdom and to see the busyness or the business that is done on earth, how neither day nor night do one's eyes see sleep. Then I saw all the work of God, that man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun. However much man may toil in seeking, he will not find it out. Even though a wise man claims to know, he cannot find it out. Then turn ahead to chapter 9, verse 11. And here we read this. Again, I saw that under the sun the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor bread to the wise, nor riches to the intelligent, nor favor to those with knowledge, but time and chance happen to them all. And then chapter 11, verses 1 to 6. It says this. Cast your bread upon the waters, for you will find it after many days. Give a portion to 7 or even to 8, for you know not what disaster may happen on earth. If the clouds are full of rain, they empty themselves on the earth as if a tree falls to the south or to the north. In the place where the tree falls, there it will lie. He who observes the wind will not sow, and he who regards the clouds will not reap. as you do not know the way of the Spirit comes to the bones in the womb of a woman with child, so you do not know the work of God who makes everything. In the morning sow your seed, and at evening withhold not your hand, for you do not know which will prosper, this or that, or whether both alike will be good. So the preacher is pretty grim. We know that. He has learned that he has no control over what will happen. He cannot prevent death. And now, by the way, he says, everything in life is uncertain. He says in chapter 8, verse 7, for he does not know what is to be, for who can tell him how it will be? There is no one that can know what's going to happen, because it does not matter who you are. We are no better off than anyone else. You can have the wise man, you can have the soothsayer, you can have the prophet, you can have the weather person, you can have the fortune teller, and all are equally ignorant. If all things come from God, if all things are controlled by God, then the preacher is saying essentially here what it says in Romans chapter 11, 33 to 34. It says this, oh, the depths of the riches and wisdom and knowledge of God, how unsearchable are his judgments and how inscrutable his ways. For who has known the mind of the Lord, or who has been his counselor? All of life is uncertain to us because God does not choose to reveal everything about what is going on in the earth that he is doing. And so for us, life is uncertain. It is unknowable. We make predictions, we have ideas, but we truly do not know. In chapter 8, 16 and 17, it says, we do not have a clue what God is doing on the earth. We may kind of bristle at this. We might say, well, you know, there are a number of things that we do know. We know about Christ coming. We know about Easter. We know about salvation. Maybe we know a lot more things than that. But do we perceive all the events of history, and even those that may we have no knowledge of, and understand what is happening? Do we know why things happen in the events that happen under the sun? Do we know why a person becomes sick, and why one person lives, and why another person dies in a car accident? Do we know why? Do you know what brings long life or prosperity? Do you know why an earthquake happens over the sea that causes a tsunami that hits the coast and kills thousands of people? Do we know anything? Do you know why in your job your boss decided to hire you and not someone else? What advantage? Do you know? Why? If you get promoted, why? Do you know why you were born in the country you were born in to the family you were born in to? For me, living in North America, that was one of the most remarkable things in my first time visiting Cuba. Communist country, poverty stricken, and I go, how is it that I was born into the place that I was born with the privileges I was born with? Why? I wasn't born. It's not like I could have made a case for myself. We don't know why. We don't have a clue what God is doing on this earth. It's all uncertain to us. Now, some say this is just cosmic chance. Everything is unpredictable. But this is not the facts. God controls all and everything, and because he works all things after the counsel of his will for his eternal and good purposes, there is not a single meaningless event on this earth. Not one. But without God, it's all vanity. It's all meaningless. Without God, everything doesn't have a purpose. But with God, everything is significant. And yet we don't know why. We don't know how. When you look at chapter 9, verse 11, we see another thing in here, is that we have no idea how things happen on earth. Solomon says that as he explored this world, he came to see that under the sun, what we expect does not occur. He says we expect that the fastest in a race should win. The strongest should win the fight. The wisest should get the food. The intelligent should get the money. And the success should come to the knowledgeable. But life is not knowable. And life is not fair. A person works like crazy. They work like a dog for years to make very little. And then some criminal comes along and buys a lottery ticket and makes millions. And go, why? You study hard. You're working hard at working on your schoolwork and getting your papers done and your assignments finished, and you end up getting a C. And then you sit beside someone who partied all the night before and he got an A. The God-fearer suffers with hardship and poverty, and the God-hater owns a beach house in Malibu and lives on a yacht. And he says that time and chance happen to all of us. It sounds like he is denying what he has said about God earlier, that God is in control. But remember again where he's speaking from. Without God in the picture, life is a gamble. And the odds are that the house is going to take your money. He also says this in chapter 11, verses 1 to 6. Is that we have no way of knowing what is going to happen. Here he makes several points about the uncertainty of the future. And we should not, he says in verse 2, that we should not count on one thing working exclusively because we don't know what is going to work and what will not work. In verses 3 and 4, he tells us that even though we do not know what will work, the response that we should have is not to just sit in as a paralytic in paralysis, not doing anything. In verse 5 to 6, he tells us we cannot begin to understand what God is doing, but we do have to act in faith. And what he's doing in telling us here is he's calling us, and he's telling us from one person who has experienced what life is all about. He has done it all, seen it all, been a part of it all, and he's giving us a practical admonition to be prudent, to use our heads, while at the same time trusting in God who makes everything and does everything. This is true if you own a business. This is true if you have been and involved in farming or if you're pursuing a career. It even is true if you need to go and pick out a washer and dryer. You don't know if the investment that you make is going to bring a return. You don't know if it's going to be a bull or a bear market. You don't know when in your garden you plant your cucumbers whether you will have a bumper crop or the rabbits are going to eat it all. You can check consumer reports and get all kinds of advice from friends and you can still buy a lemon. We have to place our trust in the one who has made all things, who sustains all things, and who directs all things. So these are the facts of life. All kinds of things are going to happen in our lives. We're going to observe all kinds of things, and every one of them is going to be controlled by God. And there's a season for everything. There's not because there's a spring, summer, fall, and winter that obeys the tilt of the earth, but because God intends it. Death is real, and all of us are going to face it. Now, is there a chance that Christ will return? Of course. We anticipate that. But unless that happens, you and I are going to die. Life happens. And you and I have no idea what is going to happen next. Nothing is certain. The facts are not always kind. It's not comfortable that we do not have control over everything. But why is he telling us this? What would be the purpose? Because I don't believe that Solomon is just, he didn't die in a dark room just lamenting life. He comes out with joy. He comes out with purpose. I believe that Solomon is showing us this so that we will not put our confidence in this world, in what we do, or what we think we can control. We can create all kinds of illusions of truth, fake news, alternate realities, and all they do is lead to meaningless lives. We can deny the reality. We can try to create a fake truth. We can put on a mask to cover our frown. We can put a fresh coat of paint on a rotting house. Or we can learn from the preacher. Earlier I said we were in chapter 3 and we'd come back to this section in verses 11 to 13. This is what it says. Also, he has put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. There's yet uncertainty. He says in verse 12, I perceive that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. Also, that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. This is God's gift to man. Now, doesn't that seem so contradictory to everything he said? But he's asking us to look at life from a different perspective. You look at it worldly, you look at it as if you're the only thing, and it is doom and gloom. But if you look at it from what God is doing and what God intends, then there's hope. We turn to God while we're kind of caught in this span between the beginning of time and eternity. That's where we are. We're caught in between that. And what he calls us to do is to abandon meaning in this world. We are to turn to God and we are to live in the light of eternity, in the light of longing for aspiring to yearning after eternity. We need to take a different view, a fresh view. We need to understand and to live out that this world was not designed to satisfy us. That was never its purpose. But what it is intended to do is to excite us for longing for another world. C.S. Lewis said this, if I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world. If none of my earthly pleasures satisfy it, that does not prove that the universe is a fraud. Probably earthly pleasures were never meant to satisfy it, but only to arouse it, to suggest the real thing. We need to take on a different perspective of the purposes of this world. This world was not designed to make you happy. What this world was designed to do, and we're talking after the fall, of course, okay? There's a context here. With all the God knew and planned would happen. We go, it was all a catastrophic mistake. He didn't anticipate what would go on and now he's just trying to make up for it. He's like he's trying to fix a leaky boat while it's in the water. No, not at all. This world is to remind us that this world is not our home. This world is designed to display over and over again in all its cruelty and all of its imperfection and all of its trouble that we should yearn for something far greater. It calls us to not regard this world with the affections that we sometimes can be caught up in. As if we live that somehow this world will make us happy and this world will bring us contentment. What this world is supposed to do is dissatisfy us. To say, if this is all there is, why bother? Until you realize there is something to bother about. It is following Christ. It is for us to anticipate our eternity by, as it says in chapter 3, verse 11, doing the business of God. He says that we should find our joy in what God has for us and what he will do through us. He has put eternity into our hearts. He's supposed to say, why am I empty? Why do I struggle with meaning? Why am I never satisfied? It's because he has put eternity into your heart. And he has said, the feeling that you have of displeasure, the feeling that you have that things are not right, like you're just out of kilter a little bit, is because you're supposed to seek after God. This world is not it. But we search. And he says, I perceive that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful. How? Because we look to Christ. We look to God. And to do good, to help people, to care for people, to bring the beauty of the gospel to people so that they can get out of this temporal, horrible existence. We do good. We do what is beneficial to others. And he tells us, enjoy what God has given you. Enjoy your friends and enjoy your family. Enjoy your leisure. Enjoy your work. Celebrate these things as coming from God. But here is the critical point in all of these things, because he'll sound so contradictory as we continue to read. He says, we're going to look at it next week, that money and leisure are meaningless. And right here he's telling us, enjoy leisure. Why does it seem like such a contradiction? Because what he is telling us here, and what we'll see more next week, is that he's saying, you want to enjoy leisure, you want to enjoy your family and your friends and food and drink, you do it as one who anticipates the banqueting table before God, the eternal fellowship with Christ, the restoration of every relationship you've ever had in the presence of God. That these are the gifts of God's grace that help us to yearn for what is greater, not to settle for now. Why would I settle for what is rotten when I can have what is perfect? But that is what we often do. So we listen to the writer and what he has to say as we live with the facts of life. Everything's going to happen in its time according to God's plan. Death is going to come to us all. And we don't know anything. But God does. We trust in Him.